Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Holly Kernan, Vice President of News at KQED in San Francisco, and I'll be your moderator for today's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Garry Kasparov. Woohoo! Garry is chairman of the Human Rights Foundation, former world chess champion, and author of the new book, Deep Thinking, Where Machine Intelligence Ends and Human Creativity Begins. Born in Baku, Azerbaijan, in the Soviet Union, Mr. Kasparov became the under-18 chess champion of the USSR at age 12. And the world, And the world under-20 champion at age 17. He gained international fame at the age of 22 as the youngest world chess champion in history. He defended his title 5 times, including a legendary series of matches against his arch-rival Anatoly Karpov. Mr. Kasparov was one of the first prominent Soviets to call for democratic and market reforms. He was an early supporter of Boris Yeltsin's push to break up the Soviet Union. In 1990, he and his family escaped ethnic violence in his native Baku as the USSR collapsed. In 2005, in his 20th year as the world's top-rated player, Mr. Kasparov retired from professional chess to join the vanguard of the Russian pro-democracy movement. In 2012, he was named chairman of the New York-based Human Rights Foundation, succeeding Václav Havel. And he was facing imminent arrest in 2013 during Vladimir Putin's crackdown, and he moved from Moscow to New York City. His U.S.-based Kasparov Chess Foundation nonprofit continues to promote the teaching of chess in the education systems around the world. Pertinent to today's discussion, Mr. Kasparov is a senior visiting fellow at the Oxford Martin School with a focus on human-machine collaboration. And I actually had to cut stuff out. He's so accomplished. He's also a member of the Executive Advisory Board of the Foundation for Responsible Robotics. As you know, 20 years ago, in May of 1997, the world watched as Mr. Garry Kasparov, the greatest chess player in the world, was defeated for the first time by the IBM supercomputer Deep Blue. He likes to point out that people forget that just a year before he won his match against computer. And he says that his competition symbolized man's fight against machine, yet years after losing to Deep Blue, 2 decades later, he's come to see how humans and machines can partner to reach results that neither can attain alone. And that is the subject of his new book, Deep Thinking. We'll get into that in a minute, but please join me in giving a warm welcome to Mr. Garry Kasparov. All right, before we get into the subject of your book and all of these interesting conversations around AI and how it's just absolutely revolutionizing our world, I'm going to start with Russia. So, given the extraordinary political moment that we're in, can you just give us some insight into what it was like to be a dissident in Putin-led Russia and how that kind of crackdown on civil liberties and democratic protest and participation intensified? Like, was it gradual? Talk to us about how that happened.
It's quite funny that 18 months ago, I was here in San Francisco and just traveled across the country promoting my previous book, Winter is Coming.
Which we'll talk about also.
Yes, why Vladimir Putin and the enemies of the free world must be stopped. Everybody wanted to ask me about IBM and Deep Blue. So now I have a new book, and I think it's inescapable. But somehow it's probably these two subjects are connected because a lot of Russian stories are connected to cybersecurity, it's not AI, but it's about interference using new technology. Now, regarding the situation in Russia, it's also quite an extraordinary moment Just arrived here today in just San Francisco airport, and while waiting for our car, so I looked at the news from Moscow from Alexei Navalny, so calling for a big rallies on June the 12th.
Huh.
So it seems that in 4 days' time, we'll have another massive rallies in Russia. There are, I think he said something at 211 cities now, just the people in these 211 Russian cities, they already expressed their desire to join these rallies against corruption, but of course it's against Vladimir Putin. Now, the reason I mention that is because that somehow answers this question that I'm being asked all the time. So, Vladimir Putin is so popular. How do you know? You know, here in this country, you can measure the popularity of a politician by looking at opinion polls. Maybe it's, you know, it could fluctuate plus one, plus minus three, four percentage points. But it cannot be, you cannot mix 80% and 30%. Now, in Putin's Russia, first of all, you have to recognize that people who are being asked anonymously, what do you think of Vladimir Putin, they feel uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable, yeah. Because it's the many of them were either born in the Soviet Union or definitely have vivid memories about Soviet Union. And asking their opinion about the KGB dictator, either by phone or on the street, yeah, puts them in some kind of, you know, it's in a jeopardy. Hmm. When they say, oh, 80% of Russian people are being asked about Putin support him, my question is, I want to look at the remaining 20%. So this means there's still 20% of people who are you know, so unhappy that they're not afraid to say what they think about Putin. Though I wouldn't pay any real attention to these polls, because the true popularity of Putin could be measured by the fact that so many people are willing to join these rallies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's even not, though it is not like
danger.
Marching here in San Francisco or New York, you know, when you are being protected by the police,
right.
Most likely you'll be confronted by riot police. And people realize that there will be a risk, but they're still willing to show their dissatisfaction, their disagreement, and their willingness to see change. Now, when Putin's regime and Putin's cronies try to organize big rallies like supporting the annexation of Crimea, they bring people from the state-paid jobs. Very often they just, you know, they give money, and it's many times was recorded, because they couldn't have enough enthusiasm, real enthusiasm, so they had to pay for that.
Mm.
So it tells you that even if 80-90% of people are not willing to take action, the actual level of support for Putin, enthusiastic support, it's quite thin.
So what led you, though, to your decision to leave the country? What were the factors that led up to that?
Oh, I got an invitation, if you may call so, to visit the Russian analog of FBI.
Invitation.
It was an invitation to be a witness on one of the many cases that they started at the time. After a big protest in 2011-2012, there was a crackdown, and many of my colleagues, they were already arrested or being investigated. And when I received it, actually I was traveling abroad, my mother received it, and I called Boris Nemtsov, late Boris Nemtsov, my friend and colleague and ally, and asked his opinion, and Boris was adamant. He said, Gary, stay away, because you enter the building, and if you leave the building, you will not be a witness anymore, but a suspect.
Mm.
So I wish he would have followed his own advice, because it was apparent at the time that a regime would not play by its own rules, and Putin wanted to eliminate any opposition. And looking at the list of people who marched with me 10 years ago, five, six years ago, on Moscow streets, they're either in jail, in exile, or worse.
So you wrote the book Winter's Coming, talking about Putin as a real danger to the world, and you were critical of the Obama administration for not taking that threat serious enough. I wish we had thought about I've listened to you a little bit more at that time, but you also say, well, we should thank Trump for showing how fragile our democratic institutions are.
No, I think looking at what's happening now, it's good that we have Trump, who is not capable to destroy it, but to show the weakness of the system, that the system could be exposed. And also, it's a wake-up call. So this is, a lot of people thought that in this country, they thought that it's, democracy is for granted. Mm. All the rights that we have been enjoying for more than two centuries, they are for granted. I remember that 2 years, 2 years ago, I was at Bill Maher show. And I tried to raise this issue about Putin and then threats. And he was so dismissive. And he ended up this conversation by saying, look, wake me up when he takes over Poland. Wow, I almost jumped on my chair, responding that I heard similar comments about 80 years ago, and we all know, you know, what was the outcome. And after November elections, Bill has changed his views and became, you know, it's a crusader, bashing Putin and Russian interference. And I couldn't, you know, I couldn't help tweeting that. It seemed that Putin skipped over Poland and went straight to Wisconsin. When I say, you know, praise Trump, is because you could see the backlash against nationalism in Europe. Mm. It's because of Trump, I believe, the Trump's unexpected victory. We saw the collapse of nationalists in Holland, mm-hmm. the Horde Wilders party that many believed was poised to win the elections were totally crushed. And by the way, it was crushed in the elections because 81% of Dutch people voted. The moment you have a majority voting, overall majority, you could see that their share of vote is not as impressive as it looked. Then, of course, France. Mm-hmm. France is, that was, by the way, a big setback for Putin. Right. He was betting on France, and they believed that they would win because they had Le Pen, they had Fillon, also very close to Putin, and Mélenchon from far left. All of them talked about lifting sanctions and basically, you know, just bringing Russia out of the cold and starting a new era of cooperation. And Putin lost, Macron has won. I think it was Trump effect. And again, I thought it was a good moment to make another joke saying that Putin bet on three cards out of four and he lost his bet. It seems that he was running out of Trump cards.
Okay, one more Russia question. Masha Gessen, who's a journalist who also had to leave Russia for her safety, like you did, recently, last week, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, and she said, "We imagine the villains of history as cunning strategists, brilliant masterminds of horror. This happens because we learn about them from history books, which weave narratives that retrospectively imbue events with logic, making them seem predetermined. Historians and their readers bring an unavoidable perception bias to the story. If a historical event caused shocking destruction, then the person behind this event must have been a correspondingly giant monster. Terrifying as it is to contemplate the catastrophes of the 20th century, it would be even more frightening to imagine that humanity has stumbled unthinkingly into its darkest moments." She goes on to say, "As someone who's spent years studying Mr. Putin, and as one of a handful of journalists who've had unscripted conversations with him, I can vouch for the fact that he is a poorly educated, underinformed, incurious man whose ambition is vastly out of proportion to his understanding of the world. To the extent that he has any interest in the business of governing, it is his role on the world stage or on Russian television that concerns him. Whether he's attending a summit, piloting a plane, or hang gliding with Siberian cranes, it is the spectacle of power that interests him." And when I read that, it made me wonder how you compare the persona of President Trump with Vladimir Putin.
You know, speaking of Trump, as we just had a conversation before walking the stage, is that, and I can repeat it here, that I think we're lucky that it was Trump who actually expose the weakness of the system. Mm-hmm. Man with no plan, with no strategy, and now we can deal with that because this is flawed, and there are so many weaknesses in his administration. It's not even being formed properly, and I think it will help America to get stronger. It's like with a virus. A virus attacks body that's with a weakened immune system. So if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. Yeah.
I don't know how comforting that is.
This is not a deadly virus.
Right.
This is not a deadly virus. So and also it's you said Putin and Trump. Let's look at Putin. because Master Gessner is a good friend, but I'm not sure I agree entirely with what he said, because in my former life, in my professional chess career, I knew there was the worst mistake one can make is to underestimate your opponent. Mm-hmm. To underestimate Putin, that's a big mistake. She's right describing him as poorly educated. Everything she said was right. But he had instincts. The fact is that the man stays in power for 18 years tells you that he's quite a savvy dictator. He knows how to manipulate people around. He won these battles in Russia among his cronies. But most important, he instinctively learned that it's a new brand new world. And you can use technology invented in the free world. You can use the free speech, the free environment of the democracy to promote your own agenda. And he knows it's not about substance. He can lie all the time. He understands that his advantages, he's not going to be called by a special counsel to testify under oath. He can do whatever. And later he can confess, yes, I lied, as he did with Crimea. If we remember, first, oh, how dare you, I'm a man of peace. Next statement, 3 months later, maybe there were some Russians, you know, vacationing patriots. Yeah. Then, a few months later, how could we let these brave people fighting alone, some form of tacit approval? And then eventually, a year later, full recognition, bragging. Oh, of course it was us, and pinning medals on the Russian troops that were part of an invasion. Now, in his mind, he did everything right because he was a KGB guy. And you all remember, even before becoming president, when he was acting prime minister and meeting his former colleagues at Lubyanka KGB headquarters in Moscow, he said, once KGB, always KGB. And lying is a part of his job. And he's amazed that he keeps lying and people are still buying it, still asking him, did you do that? He said, no, I didn't. By the way, by saying I didn't, he's looking back at Russian people saying, of course I did it. Yes. This is these idiots. They just don't understand it. So let's sell this nonsense to them. And it's all about his appearance. And as long as he's being treated as the most powerful man on the planet, by the way, two consecutive years, Forbes magazine, that's what counts. He knows, not because he read books like us, but because he has his instincts that no one ever in history attacked a strong dictator. As long as dictator looks strong, there will be no uprising.
Well, let me get to the point about lies. You tweeted, I think yesterday, the point of modern propaganda isn't only to misinform or push an agenda, it's to exhaust your critical thinking and to annihilate truth. And I think that my concern is, how can our sort of democratic society withstand this level of mendacity and chaos? What advice do you have to Americans right now?
Again, first of all, you should realize that this threat does exist. It's better late than never. Also, Putin found out that he can weaponize this fake news industry. And by the way, I could see there are a few people here that speak Russian in this audience, more than a few. They should be aware that this business of creating fake news industry has started in Russia many years ago by confronting Russian opposition, by creating this fake presence on the internet to lead people who were looking for alternative news, who were not happy with the Channel 1, Channel 2 propaganda machine. So it worked. It's because if you show up on the internet and you look, if you're browsing there and you find a website that looks decent and has some news, but it also sells you not 100% lies as Channel 1, but it has its own window where it has to make sure that while you buying the credentials of the website, you will not notice that some of the elements of the story, they are just fake news. Then Putin went beyond Russia to the Russian to neighboring countries, Russian speaking world, and it worked again. And of course, he decided that he could use it globally, having created troll factories and also many lobbyists, and finding he was quite successful, because again, he's a KGB dictator, finding these weak spots in the free world, because you can lie in 100 different ways. Mm-hmm. And now with all these social media channels, you can manipulate public opinion by amplifying this as the fake stories.
And with AI.
Someone will pick it up. And it's more difficult to tell the truth because there's only one way.
For instance, and it's nuanced.
It's news. It's the exactly. For instance, when Russia missile hit the plane, MH17, the plane, it was not just blunt denial. They came up with 10 different versions. Yeah. Oh, it was Ukrainian missile. No, it was Ukrainian jet fighter. No, it was a plane full of dead bodies sent from Holland. One of the versions. It's just 10 different versions. But by the way, one day it was amazing on Russian television, two different channels. They both confronted the report of the Dutch investigators, and they had two different versions of truth, quote unquote. One talked and with all the diagrams showing that it was a Ukrainian missile. Another one talked about Ukrainian jet fighter, almost at the same time. Again, it doesn't matter. So it's because you can throw this nonsense to or just all sorts of alternative versions into the public, and somebody will buy it. It's Putin's danger, and it's somehow I would argue even more dangerous than the Soviet propaganda, because he doesn't have to sell you anything. The Soviet propaganda was limited because they had a story to sell. They had to convince you that, you know, Soviet Union is country for peace, and they could support only certain political groups, left, far left, anarchists, communists. Putin, no, doesn't matter. He can go with far left, far right. Anything that disturbs status quo, anything that spreads chaos is good for him. And he can sell whatever. So he knows how to weaponize everything. Refugees from Syria, fantastic. So let's push more of them to Europe because they will disturb political balance and they will attack or they will create problems for mainstream parties like for Angela Merkel, for in France, in other countries. So spreading chaos with Putin's resources and with the openness of the West and total being totally unprepared for this kind of onslaught, that worked for him.
So what's your advice to ordinary Americans?
First of all, you understand that this threat does exist. And it's not a minor threat. I understand there's ISIS and other things, but you should also look at Putin as the main source of problem because his resources and his ability to attack you simultaneously on many fronts. You should recognize that this
threat... You think Putin is more dangerous to American society than ISIS?
Are you kidding me? I ask you now. A couple of weeks ago when Comey was Director Comey was on the Senate floor, he said bluntly, "It's Russia is the most dangerous nation on earth, considering the United States' interests, because of its intentions and resources." ISIS comes and go. We can spend a lot of time talking about conspiracy theories and how many potential KGB infiltrators there, because you look at the Saddam officers that work with Russia. Then you have many field commanders from North Caucasus that mysteriously, you know, came to Syria. Then it's about very strange relations between Assad and ISIS because they're not fighting each other. They're not fighting. And by the way, Russian planes never bombed ISIS. When you look at the Putin's operation in Syria, he always bombed American-backed, Western-backed rebels because he knows that Assad and ISIS, they all help him to create chaos. Mm-hmm. So you have to fight back. There are many ways you can hurt Putin because as long as he looks strong, he will not be challenged. But you have to make him look like a loser. And there are many things that you can do. Start hurting them where it hurts. Look, follow the money. Oh, you say you have sanctions. Yes, you have sanctions. But as long as, let's say, Gennady Timchenko, one of the top oligarchs, Putin's friend, as long as his wife can run his business from Geneva, of course, he can sit in St. Petersburg being denied visa access to Europe. Big deal. So it's and the same is Macron can say many tough things facing Putin. But as long as Total is making business with Timchenko's company Novatek in Russia, Putin doesn't care. Wars are cheap. So Putin's empire depends on the West complacency and willingness to make money no matter what. And we still yet to see a proper response from the United States and Europe, just making sure, not so much for Putin, but for his cronies that the continuing aggression will have a very high price.
What do you miss most about living in Moscow?
I have my mother. She lives in Moscow. She's 80. It was too hard for her to move outside of Russia. She has two sisters, nephews, nieces. So I have my son also there who lives with her from a previous marriage. It's a lot of relatives there. So my wife and our kids, they were in New York now. But it's coming back and forth would be ideal, but it's for me now, it's a one-way ticket.
All right, let's turn to deep thinking. Artificial intelligence is already changing so much about society, about work, and yet, to get to the 2016 election again, we were having debates about, you know, coal mining jobs and manufacturing sector, rather than how do we adapt to this future that is not just coming, it's here. And you're an optimist, which is wonderful. I love that about the book, that you really think that if we combine machine power with human-powered thinking, that that's going to be good for the future. Can you just talk to us a little bit about how you frame your thinking around machine learning and AI, artificial intelligence?
The idea behind the book was to combine, you know, a few themes. One is it was my personal story. It's being part of this human-machine competition and what I learned from that. Another one was the story. It's a history of human-machine relations. And I thought it would be important to write it in just plain language explaining that it's a natural progress. And you have to demystify that because there's so much panic based on this dystopian vision from Hollywood, the Terminator, the Matrix. You know, let's slow down, you know, just make sure that, you know, we look at the problem objectively. And, of course, looking into the future and promoting the what I believe is the future scenario, human plus machine collaboration. And that was the outcome of my matches with DeepBlue when I just realized you can't beat them, join them. But what is this? I think it's, as you mentioned again, the elections and politics. It's always bothers me this kind of hypocrisy, because machines for centuries, if not for millennials, have been taking over all forms of manual labor. Now, when machines were taking over jobs from, you name it, manufacturing jobs, that's natural. Now, the only difference is machines coming after people with college degrees, political influence, and Twitter accounts. And that suddenly it's a big story. But again, in the history timeline, it's just a leap forward. And we just have to realize that many, I would say, more menial aspects of cognition will be taken over by the machines. Now, of course, it's fear. Oh, what are we going to do? There's still so much room for us to apply our creativity when machine intelligence ends and human creativity begins. That's the subtitle of the book. Because what I learned, and I could try to put it in just in kind of formula, anything that we do, and we know how we do this, machines will do better. Mm-hmm. Now, the emphasis is on we know how we do. There's so much
that you can program. Codify,
something that you can codify and send to the machine. Now, there's so much we are doing without knowing how we do that. And it's not just simply emotional things. It's a lot of decisions we made that based on parallel tracks. It's multi-layer decisions, and machines always know the odds, but they will not be able to make decisions because they will have to compare incompatible things. Recently I just thought about, just had a speech in Amsterdam about 10 days ago for a bunch of AI experts, and I wanted to come up with something that's like a vivid example. And I thought, do you all remember the Empire Strikes Back? The moment when Han Solo was bringing his spaceship into the asteroid field, trying to escape from the Imperial fleet. And C-3PO tells him in panic, the chances of surviving in the asteroid field, 3,720 to 1. And the response, never tell me the odds. Now, it's a very important moment because machine was right. The chances of surviving were slim to none. But machine couldn't realize that the chances of not getting there or even less, because you will be caught and then killed, or even worse. So many things that's for machines, knowing the odds and making precise calculation of your chance of success, machines will never give you the right advice, and that means we have still have room to cooperate, collaborate, and make most efficient decisions. And it goes even beyond these extreme situations.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So then, many cases, for instance, you are in the store and you want to buy something, and it's off your budget. It's too expensive. Now, machines definitely shows that we recommend against it. But now the problem is the birthday party, and you have to give you have to buy a gift, and you can start adding this little things, and as you realize that it will be impossible for a machine to combine them and to come up with decision that will be satisfactory to you. I'm just having a dream that maybe 20, 25 years ago, hope I'll be around to see it. I'm sure our kids, grandchildren will be sitting here saying, oh, these stupid people, they were driving cars. Look at the statistics, you know, the greatest cause of death. Now we're talking about driverless cars. What will happen? By the way, no matter what we think about it, it's going to happen.
It's happening.
It is happening, and we just have to make sure that we know what we're going to do. And it's not about saving jobs. These jobs cannot be saved. I believe that is the problem is not jobs being lost too fast. I think it's too slow because it slows down the cycle.
Huh.
Because what happens always at the end of the cycle, you have a new cycle. Because before any technology creates jobs, it kills jobs. So if you slow down this part of the cycle, you will prevent it starting the new cycle of economic growth and possibly, you know, creating new sustainable jobs. Now, we have to take care about people, because a lot of people, they have great difficulty, especially my age or older, we have great difficulty of adjusting. So you just have to find out how to generate enough income and enough opportunities to make sure these people will find their spot, because, again, it's going to happen. And trying to slow down just makes it more painful.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and our guest today is Russian human rights activist and former world chess champion Garry Kasparov. I'm Holly Kernan, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio. You can catch up with the club on Facebook and Twitter, and you can see program videos on the club's YouTube channel. All right, let's go to a question from our audience, which is, how did you get interested in playing chess? It was your mom, right?
Unfortunately, nobody was there to tweet this moment. it's a pity. So that's why I cannot tell you exactly when it happened. It was probably winter evening, 68, late 68, early 69, in Baku, watching my parents trying to solve a chess puzzle. I'm sure in this audience, I look at the age. Many people remember there were the newspapers with a little section at the bottom of the last page with chess puzzles, and I was captivated by the game. So I didn't know how to move the pieces, but I was in awe immediately with the game, and so I was lucky. So I found it. I learned how to by watching them moving the pieces. I learned how these pieces learned the basic rules, and. That was the moment.
That was the moment.
That's the legend says so.
When you were talking about your match with Deep Blue, the second one, the one that you lost, you said humans crack under pressure, machines don't. And then at the end of your book, you say humans can dream, machines cannot.
So what is the contradiction? It's this. Just one comment. It's about human machine competition, and it's why why it's useless now just to fight machines in any games. And we could see now that's the same happening in Go, and it's every game will be eventually cracked. Or to be more precise, machine will crunch it by winning, because it's not about solving the game of chess. The number of legal moves in the game of chess is 10 power 45, which they say it's more than number of atoms in the solar system. Let's agree it's unlimited. But machine doesn't have to calculate everything and to make a first move announcing mate in 20,555 moves. It's about winning the game. So winning the game means that you make less mistakes than your opponent. And humans cannot play the same steady game. So we always make mistakes or even inaccuracies, and that's enough for machine to capitalize. So that's why this pressure is too much for humans to bear. And now we could see the same in Go. But again, it doesn't tell you that we are dealing with form of AI, because Deep Blue was as intelligent as your alarm clock. though, of course, losing to $10 million alarm clock didn't make me feel any better. No, seriously, it was a very successful project of parallel processors. Deep Blue's speed was phenomenal in 97, still amazing today, 200 million positions per second. But when you look at the way this machine made decisions, it could offer you very little, if any, dreamt of input into the mysteries of human intelligence. Machine didn't need intelligence to play this game of chess. Chess was vulnerable to the brute force once hardware got fast enough and algorithm got smart enough. Today we have computers, by the way, that are just far more sophisticated and stronger than Deep Blue, and I always surprise people saying that a free chess app on your mobile phone is stronger than Deep Blue. Just trust me.
So here's another audience question. What's your perseverance technique after you lose a game?
Look, I didn't lose many.
So I didn't need to develop a technique?
No, it's the... It's a good question. So first of all, I believe that every game, whether I won or lost, was an important piece of information I had to learn from. In one of my earlier books, How Love Imitate Chess, I spoke about the gravity of past success, that we know that we have to learn from our mistakes and from our losses, but we believe that if we won, it's because we were great. So I knew that every game, even if I won, contained certain mistakes and certain inaccuracies. I have to learn about it and make sure next day I will be armed with some new ideas, because my opponents who lost, they will find these mistakes and they'll come back with new ideas as well. So losing the game, which was quite painful, I confess in the book, I was a sore loser. Yes, sore loser. But you cannot stay on top for 20 years if you're not a sore loser, because you have to take it very personal. First of all, it's you. It's you made a mistake, you have to find it, you have to kick yourself in the head. But it's just coming back next day. It's just another game. It's the same story as the game you won, because it brings you very valuable information. So it's more painful, but at the end of the day, it's about your ability to learn from these lessons. And again, I was angry, but I always thought that now I have a chance to come back being stronger, because what I learned from my mother from my childhood is, game of chess was not just about winning or losing. Of course, it was about winning. But the most important thing, it was my chance to make the difference. That's why, by the way, I succeeded in just moving away from chess and doing other things, because it's about making the difference. And I know that if I can make the difference, I'm on the right path.
You, there's a quote in your book that I love, which is, "Hard work is talent."
Absolutely. It's just I'm not happy when I hear all the time, "Oh, this person's talented. This one is less talented, but he's a hard worker." That's part of the talent. Working hard is a part of the talent, and it's a very important part of the talent.
I love that. Okay, so here's a question from the audience. I'm mostly using the ones who are doing big print because I left my glasses back stage, so I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time reading some of them. How do you see AI, or do you, taking part to eliminate human bias and discrimination? It's a hard one.
You know, it's a big mistake considering this device as that's something that is good by definition.
He's holding up his smartphone.
Yes, my and that's Android. So it's there. It's neither good nor bad. It's agnostic. You can do many great things with this. You can connect with friends. You can do business transactions. Unfortunately, you can build a terrorist network with that as well. Mm-hmm. So it's the same with AI. It's not going to change our lives. Because if it's the hands of Putin or ISIS, it will not work for positive things, but it will serve the destruction. So that's why I think it's a big mistake trying to sort of to shift our responsibilities to AI, to machines. Mm. It's in our hands, so we just have to make sure that these tools will serve us, our interest, our community, our country, the world, the mankind, because there were always people that will try to use the same technology to destroy. It's every technology. It's like coins with two sides. So with nuclear technology, you can have a nuclear power station, but you can have a nuclear bomb. Mm-hmm. So it's the same as here. So that's why I warn you not to expect paradise because we just reach a new level of technological development.
Well, and that's where you say we have to combine human intelligence and
Absolutely.
Compassion and
exactly.
qualities
need,
with
need,
machine
exactly.
learning.
Exactly. The human factor is indispensable, absolutely indispensable. And it's not just, you know, humans having passion and understanding and machines cannot match it, but it's about purpose. Machines have the best algorithms, and eventually we could have the something phenomenal, you know, the best algorithm in the universe, but machines will never have purpose. And one of the reasons, because we do have purpose, but we don't know what it is. We'll never share the secret with the machines.
All right, here's another question from our audience. Aside from the Turing test, how will we know when real AI has arrived? Explain the Turing test.
Yeah, but this is if you cannot that was the original idea of the founding father of computer science, Alan Turing, thinking that in the moment that you will not be able to tell the machine from a human by asking questions, that's artificial intelligence. Mm. Ironically, Turing and also other founding fathers of the computer science like Claude Shannon, they believed that chess could be an ultimate test. They were, by the way, wrong because, as I said, you know, it's the Deep Blue won the match, and now we have these many very small computers, chess engines, that playing great chess by far stronger than Deep Blue, but you cannot call them intelligent. I don't know that there will be this watershed moment. So this is the moment when we believe machine is intelligent. It's not just one day in the calendar. This is not a day that's day in history. I think it's happening. Mm-hmm. But if we talk about intelligence, we probably have to now leave the Department of Science and move into the philosophy. Because first question is, what is intelligence? What is consciousness? And when we are looking for machine's intelligence, are we looking for the result or the process? How are we going to tell it? By machine solving the problem and coming up with a result that is intelligent, or we have to make sure that it happens the way that we can understand it, so that we could see these the similar paths of getting from A to B as if we done it on our own. My opinion, I'm not an expert, just more just amateur. I think it's more about the result. Because when you look at the latest incarnations of early AI, like DeepMind, Google's DeepMind, AlphaGo, unlike Deep Blue or any other chess engine, where if you have a couple of hundred years to spare and look at the million miles of logs, you'll find out the origin of the decision. With AlphaGo, it's more of a deep learning, and I don't think even Demis Hassab is the man behind the program and his team. They will ever tell you why version 6 played better than version 9. Because it's literally black box. So there's this, which is, again, it's good and bad. It's good because it's deep learning. It's so self-improving. But if it gets bugged, you'll never find out what it is. So, it's a new challenge. I wouldn't be too fearful about it because it's a part of the process. We just have to get adjusted to it.
Why do you think chess is such a powerful and enduring metaphor for human intelligence?
I would probably add in the Western world, because if you look at Japan or China, they have their own versions of chess. In Japan, the most popular game is not Go but Shogi. It's the Japanese version of chess. And the chess being played around the world, we don't know exactly how it's happened. That's the game moved in different directions over centuries and absorbed social cultural traditions of certain countries. That's why the Oriental versions of chess are very different from ours. But everywhere it's being judged as an ultimate test for intelligence. I think the fact is that the game survived for so long. And even today, at a time with computers, it's still being treated with this great respect. Just for instance, in the Japanese shogi champions, Mejuns, there's a history for almost 400 years, and it's just the list of people that are just considered to be the smartest in the nation.
Do you still enjoy playing chess?
Oh, I still love the game. I'm watching this. I follow this. I play some exhibitions. As you mentioned, Kasparov Chess Foundation is very active in this country and around the world. And I'm an active part of this process. It's not only working with blueprints and schools, but promoting the game as the important educational tool, which I think it's another big discussion about education and what chess can do for that and the role of AI in this. But also we have programs for rising stars, and I can proudly say that after 10 years of our work with young Americans, talented kids, this country has the strongest junior team in the world. Next month in St. Louis, Missouri, there will be a match between U.S. juniors and the rest of the world. So that's the...
It's almost like Big Blue.
Chess will always stay in my life. I would say now it's still 25 to 30% of my activities are somehow connected to the game of chess. I'm very happy with that.
Here's another audience question. As the population ages and many have less mental ability, can AI come to the rescue? I love this question. I hope the answer is yes.
The answer is yes, but you have to find a way. It's a new technology, and naturally, it's not just kills jobs, but it will create certain opportunities. And I think the opportunities they are unlimited, and it's just we have to find a way to apply it. We have been doing so many things that we abandoned because it was too risky, like space exploration, deep ocean exploration, and many other things here on our planet that we could revisit because we have such a powerful alliance with intelligent machines.
You mentioned Go. Somebody wants to know if you play Go, and can you talk about the differences and similarities between Go and chess?
No, I don't play Go. I know the rules.
That's why you have to
be very, very cautious in taking my advice about the game of Go and comparing to chess. What I understand, and we're looking at the game that it was played between AlphaGo, the deep learning machine from Google, and the two matches with top players, Go players. Go is a very strategic game. It's, you may even say, more complicated than chess because it doesn't have the same tactical resolutions, and the game goes longer. And that means that even if AlphaGo, and I'm not in a position to judge it, but I feel it's not as powerful as the chess engines. We're talking about absolute numbers. But the human performance in Go is way below the average performance of when it's average performance of the world champion, of course. In chess. So the mistakes that humans make in Go, because its game is so complicated, they could be far more dramatic. So, for instance, I think that Magnus Carlsen today, the current world champion, having white pieces against machine, I think if he wants to make a draw, I would bet on him saving the game. Hmm. Now, in Go, I don't need a chance. You can. It seems that now they're doomed because they cannot. They cannot exercise the same control of the game as the world champion can do in chess.
Here's another question from the audience. Do you think that chess has been trivialized by computers?
If you look at number of people who are playing chess today versus 20 years ago, the answer is no. It depends what you expect. So is the it was trivialized because chess amateur now can follow the matches of top players, worshipping every move they make when it's a blunder, but being highly critical. But I remember when I played matches with Karpov, even grandmasters who followed the game from the press center, they were very cautious, almost afraid to criticize us, even if they saw there was a mistake. Hmm. Today, you can hear people laughing around the world watching the game if the machine shows that it was a big blunder. So trivialization also means that millions of chess fans now can follow the game, not being fooled by the magnanimous presence of the world champion. So they just look at the quality of the moves and they can follow the game, realizing what's happening on the board.
Here's another question. I read somewhere that you lost against the IBM program due to a bug. The program didn't know what to play and played a random move. You were then taken aback by the move. It wasn't sort of a logical move, right? The queen?
By the book.
So the whole story is in the book.
There, so okay. I don't want to repeat it.
Well, then there's a follow-up here.
One of the early fake news stories.
Okay, here's another chess question. I get overconfident after a few moves in chess, and then I lose the game. How should I control that?
I think your problem is they go way beyond chess. It's to get overconfident, you have to win few games, not to make few moves.
You mentioned, here's another question from Paul in our audience, you mentioned that lies exhaust critical thinking. What are your predictions for the future of natural intelligence and the faculty of critical thinking? Softball.
It's going back to the realm of politics.
Yes.
There's no easy answer because lies very often they don't look like lies. They look like real stories.
It's the point of good propaganda.
You should be sort of you should educate yourself. Now, as an advice, what you can try to do is just always look for some competing sources, because that's one of the ideas of this fake news avalanche, is that you're sick and tired of these 100 different stories, and you're looking for refuge, mm-hmm. For one or two trusted sources. Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
Or you tune out altogether.
Yeah, but exactly. So this. We knew that there was one way of brainwashing exercise in the communist countries, just no information. Iron Curtain, just, you starved. Now it's just exactly the opposite. You're really fed up with this so much information, and you cannot verify it, so you run away. Mm-hmm. Just look for some competing sources and try to just, at the end of the day, it should be your opinion. Because it's important to understand, when there's a story there or there's an opinion. So try to make a distinction between the facts and interpretation, mm-hmm. because they're not quite good in packing this together. So it's as if it's a story, but there's always an opinion inside. So try to see where the factual story ends and opinion that they want you to buy begins.
This is a relay.
When fake news, intelligence ends and human creativity begins.
Exactly. I don't like the term fake news. As somebody who's a practitioner of news, I think
it's not news.
It's propaganda.
It is propaganda.
It's an oxymoron.
It's propaganda, but it's the. But again, that's the part of this technological progress. We have new technology that allows bad guys to promote their agenda. And it's easier. It's always easier to find the destructive ends for new technology than something that is more productive.
Here's another audience question about the same subject. What is the role of AI and big data in targeting fake news targeted to individuals, and what will it be going forward? This really gets to sort of the weaponization of...
Absolutely. It's important. Just a few weeks ago, Facebook has announced that they would hire 3,000 people to join their machines to fight fake news.
So just what you're prescribing
exactly.
in your book.
Absolutely. So it's because no matter how well-trained is the machine, how smart is the machine, the human plus machine, and that's one of the key... lessons that from my chess matches with Deep Blue and other computers and also further experiments with humans and machines, human plus machine will always be the machine, no matter how strong is the machine, because human can guide the machine and find the weak spot. It's very important that the human behind the machine, that's an just important correction of this concept, should not necessarily be the sort of the greatest expert in his field. Moreover, I would argue, if we're talking about chess, for instance, that you rather have a good operator than a strong player supporting the machine. Because just... Okay.
Explain that a little bit more.
Just look at the ratings. In chess, we have ratings. So it's the Magnus Carlsen, world champion, is rating now currently 28-30, something like that. So it's the his peak was 28-80. My peak... 20 years ago, it was 28.51. Most of the players there in 2700, top players, early 2800. Bobby Fischer in 72 was 27.85. There's the inflation, but we're talking about this 27, 2800 category. Machines today play with a rating of 3300.
Wow.
Now, that tells you that it's you don't have to be a very strong player to work with a machine, because if you're a strong player, you instinctively play your own game. But you should realize that you are 500 points weaker than machine. So that's why you rather have, it doesn't matter, you rather have a 2,000 player who is a good machine operator who will be assisting the machine, not trying to make machine as an assistance for his own game. So the same things happen, just I believe it's not only in chess, but maybe in fighting the fake news, because it's very important for us to understand what is our role. Sometimes maybe we can take a lead. And just to make a final decision, but it's very important that we know exactly where we can add, where our creativity adds to the machine's intelligence. And I think that's the fake news or propaganda battlefield will be a very important battlefield for humans and AI fighting other humans and AI. It's a new world where the news perception become reality.
Here's another audience question. AI already controls Wall Street, so will we let it take over the government as well?
Okay, I'm not sure about Wall Street, so it's what it means. So it's the of course algorithms that, but though
people have been able to game the stock market to some extent.
Well, I think it's from my limited knowledge is that the most successful groups they're using this the combination human plus machine. Plus machine collaboration, that's the most successful groups. But speaking about the future, we can look in the distant future and be really concerned about machines' role, maybe destructive role. But like in chess, you have to look at the current moment and see what are the threats today. So just to make sure that you are not jumping over thinking about strategy in the end game while you could be destroyed in the middle game. So my answer is that for those who are so concerned is that instead of panicking about too much artificial intelligence in the future, we should be truly concerned about the lack of intelligence in the Oval Office today.
All right. This is also a question from our audience, and there's a lot in your book about this. So there's been a lot of concern expressed by people regarding AI and automation taking all of our jobs, and you definitely talk about that. Some people have proposed a government-backed basic income so that people can deal with the fact that AI is taking over, automation is taking over so many jobs. What do you think of the idea of a basic minimum income?
No, it's I would go beyond that just because we are not talking about just about scientific problem or a social problem or a political problem. It's a combination of problems. Mm-hmm. It's societal, and it's about our vision of the future. Yes, we recognize these things are happening, and it's another problem with technological progress, because it's not only technology that's as this piece, but it's also a better diet, better medicine, which means people live longer, and they could work longer, and they would like to be active. But at the same time, the more jobs that are just entering the market, they are connected to new technology. It's difficult for them because of their age to learn. So it's another paradox, which means that we have to look for a comprehensive solution. That's why I'm saying don't try to save the jobs that are being that will be lost anyway. Think about people, how we can integrate them into this new world. I think that there are many opportunities, and we have to make sure that people will find something for them to do, because new technology will generate economic growth and there should be more resources. It's not just about basic income. It's about finding the way to make sure that people in the productive age, still in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, they will have something to do, because some jobs will be lost, but some opportunities will be found. So let's have this big debate. It's a serious debate that includes every aspect of the society. But the worst thing we can do is just to pretend that, oh, let's slow it down. Postpone the decision, somebody else will make it.
No, which is essentially what we're doing, right?
Exactly.
How do we bring back coal jobs?
Absolutely. Yeah, so that's, but we cannot, it's, you know, trying at the same time to debate seriously climate change and saving jobs that are clearly in contradiction with this goal. So it's, again, it's not just hypocrisy, it's kind of cognitive dissonance. So.
Well, you say something that's very hopeful, which is that we often do our best thinking under pressure. We're clearly under a lot of pressure right now. What are, you know, speaking of the societal debates we should be having and the conversations we should be having, what are the big questions you think we should be asking?
Oh, it's the, let me just let's just start with this just chess metaphor, because chess has been used very often to explain certain moves, geopolitical moves, and yeah. And I heard during some of crisis moments like in Syria that Obama played checkers, Putin played chess. That annoyed me because I had to defend the integrity of my game. Now. Dictators don't play chess because chess is a game of strategy and it's a game of transparency. Mm. So this is 100% information is transparent. You don't know what your opponent is planning, but you know exactly the resources that could be used to harm you.
And it's a level playing.
Exactly, yeah. Dictators always look for short-term resolutions, tactical moves, the game where they can enjoy their advantage of not being constrained by the parliament, by the free press, by the public opinion. Now, to the contrary, democracies should enjoy its strategic advantage. It's about building the strategy, vision of the future, institutions that will work beyond the tenure of a president or a senator or whoever is behind this the plan. So far, these all the debates, political debates, they are just being centered just around. It's all of them very short term. It's all, what are we going to do now, just to get some votes tomorrow in the midterm elections, or maybe okay, just next presidential elections. But that's not the way to move forward. Democracies, the free world, must eventually come up with the comprehensive vision of the future. What does the future will look like 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 20 years from now? Because we can make it happen, and it's very important for us to start discussing the parameters of that and looking for long-term strategic solutions contrary to these tactical responses to the problems that just being popping up all the time.
And we're just about out of time, so I'm going to take the opportunity to just quote from your book, which is that you trust young people who are growing up with technology to be smart about this. And your advice to the rest of us is, I hope you will take this as an invitation to take an active role in creating the future you want to see.
Absolutely. I think it's democracy offers a unique chance to participate. And somebody who grew up in the communist country, I appreciate it. And again, now it's the moment where you could see how your participation can change things and how your inaction also changes things in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
By the way, always try to make the difference.
Nice. Our thanks to Garry Kasparov, chairman of the Human Rights Foundation. Former world chess champion and author of the new book, which I highly recommend, Deep Thinking, Where Machine Intelligence Ends and Human Creativity Begins. I also want to thank our audience here on radio, television, and the internet, and for all your great questions. We want to remind everybody that copies of Mr. Kasparov's book are on sale in the lobby, and he'll be pleased to sign the books on stage following the program. If you'll all please remain seated immediately following this program, a member of the club's staff will provide details on the signing. I'm Holly Kernan, Vice President of News at KQED, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you.